the U.S. Space Force challenges competitors and adversaries amongst the stars. This is Brief Before Impact. Hey, welcome everyone. I am Matt Parker. We're going to be concluding our Modern Warfare series discussing the U.S. Space Force. It is the most recent and most recently created branch for the Department of Defense, and it's only got a couple of years under its belt. I thought this would be a great way to finish off this series, and I hope you've enjoyed learning about each of our military's branches, their missions, their little bit of their history, and more importantly, how they've been reevaluating their own tactics and procedures as warfare and geopolitics continues to change around the globe, especially in following pandemic of COVID and moving on to the most recent events of Russia invading Ukraine. But before we get started, I'm going to be talking about the, being this is Memorial Day weekend, I wanted to shout out to remember all of those who have gone on before us, who have fought valiantly and died for this great country and all of our, for all of our freedoms and the prosperity to continue. We have to remember and celebrate their lives and remember their names well. And so I hope you've all enjoyed the Memorial Day weekend with your families. And if you have a moment, just keep those men and women in mind who have paid the ultimate sacrifice for the greatest nation on this earth. Let me take a quick ad break and then we will get to work. Now, welcome back, everyone. So I'm going to be talking about, to start off this U.S. Space Force episode, the culture, the mission, what the U.S. Space Force is, what it's trying to become. And then we're going to kind of pivot into the emerging threats and what it is combating with, what it sees itself combating in the future, some lessons it's taken away from recent geopolitical events, and just how, to cap it off, how the Space Force interacts with the private sector, which can be seen in many of the Department of Defense branches. So let's just start off, what in fact does the Space Force do? Well, according to the spaceforce.mil, their website, the U.S. Space Force is responsible for organizing, training, and equipping Guardians, that is the name of their members, to conduct global space operations that enhance the way our joint and coalition forces fight, while also offering decision makers military options to achieve national objectives. Okay, that's kind of a mission statement, a little bit broad. Let's dig into a little bit to what that actually means. For example, global space operations. You know, what does that entail? So Space Force Guardians, according to USO.org, they help facilitate federal and commercial rocket launches, operate DoD satellites, monitor for threats, they track space debris, and much more. They ensure that the U.S. maintains its space superiority, required to protect against hostile attacks. If you remember back in episode 41, an episode I titled Space, the Final Battlefield, I really talked about the threats ongoing in space and how that's been developing over the last several years. I encourage you to go back and listen to that one. And we'll be kind of highlighting a few of those again. But the Space Force, like I mentioned earlier, it's the newest branch of the military. And they established it on December 20th, 2019, during the Trump administration. And this is really from a growing pressure from geopolitical competitors and security interests, encouraging Congress to kind of formally create a service dedicated to protecting America's space interest. Because prior to this, the U.S. Air Force had its own space command, and so it fell underneath their purview. However, Congress realized that this needed its own, mission, I should say, in space needed its own branch, its own focus, its own budget, more importantly. And so this is what led to the establishment of the Space Force. So as you can imagine, if you've ever seen a commercial advertising, any of the military branches, each of the branches have obviously their own mission, but they also have their own culture. And in my opinion, I think the branch that does the best advocating for itself, best advertising for itself, I really think that's the U.S. Marines. I think their ability to get some young individual inspired, give them goosebumps on a commercial just to get excited about, you know, going to war for their country. I really think the Marines are best at it. A tremendous amount of pride around their regiment. And very much, I think the idea of being a very challenging, physically and mentally challenging environment inspires a lot of young folks who are just going to test their mettle, see what they're capable of. I think the Marine Corps does it better than anybody, really. The other branches are fine. And all of them have their different missions. And that same advertising, that marketing, that branding, if you will, that you see on TV, that reflects their culture in many ways. And I'll just use the Marine Corps as an example. You see the videos, the commercials of Marines, you know, carrying heavy rucksacks, running into fire, jumping off the back of a helicopter or airplane, going towards the gunfire, right? The challenge, that grit and so forth. They're doing it together, being the few, the proud, the Marines. It's an incredible deal of marketing going on there. And that does reflect the culture of the Marine Corps. And so does each of the cultures of each of the branches. So as the Space Force is in its nascent phase, it's got to figure out, okay, what is our culture? You know, what are we going to be known as? An article written by Mark Natal, who's actually an Army officer who did an inter-service transfer to the Space Force, meaning he just went from the Army to the Space Force as it was created, wrote an article asking this question, what is the Space Force's culture? And he says this is a tough question to answer, mainly because the culture doesn't fully exist yet. Now, obviously, a large proportion of the Space Force's initial personnel and culture came from the Air Force. However, after just listening to Chief of Space Operations General Raymond conduct a town hall meeting with other inter-service transfers, it became very clear that the Space Force needs a very different culture, purposely distinct from the Air Force. Guardians must be of high character, able to establish connection, demonstrate commitment, and possess courage. The best way to meet these objectives is to build a service culture of professionalism and innovation, as well as bring in the right people. And we are going down the right path with this proposed uniforms, the holistic wellness approach, and we need to take a step further, that Natal argues. He says, the Space Force needs beards. Now, when I read this, I thought this really got my attention. Like, for example, when special operations guys are deployed to combat theaters, often they're rocking really long beards. Now, he argues that the Space Force wouldn't have an unkept Spec Ops beards, but rather something much more well-groomed. And he's got his reasons behind it. Now, not just allowing beards, but endorsing it, especially for officers. This is going to distinguish that Space Force team and show that they really care more about the Guardian's abilities than upholding outdated traditions. Recently, the British Army tweeted, "We have updated our hair policy to better reflect modern society. They believe it's a key factor in recruitment and retention, and Natal argues that we should too." This is actually a really interesting idea, because this is a huge thing. If you've never served in the military, you will encounter some traditions and rules that just don't make sense. I'll give you an easy one. For example, in the Army, well, at least when I was there, you weren't supposed to ever have your hands into your pants pockets. Like just sitting there, maybe reaching in for a phone or something like that, but you couldn't just stand around with your hands in your pockets. You would get yelled at by certain folks. Now, I was in Special Forces. We didn't care. We did it all the time. However, this is an actual thing, and you think, well, that's a dumb rule, and of course it is. It is stupid, but that's aspects of the military, and those rules are there, therefore you have to follow them. And Natal is arguing, how do we create a culture that's much more about, I just want results versus some outdated traditions? You know, we emphasize the talent of individuals, not just how well you can, in this case, keep your hands out of your pockets or not, keep your face shaved, things like that. Now, for example, a recent adjustment that Space Force made to kind of accommodate this idea is Guardians are officially allowed to have one small neck tattoo each, longer mustaches, and more makeup for the ladies under their new Space Force grooming and uniform policy. Now, neck tattoos are still out of the question for Air Force airmen, even though both of the services technically fall under the larger Department of Air Force umbrella. So this is, again, allowing a neck tattoo. This is a big thing for the Army when I was in. One of the sergeant majors of the Army allowed tattoos that went down, like what we call sleeve tattoos, going all the way down to your wrist or even on your hands, where those were technically not allowed or you couldn't get them after you were already in. It's just adopting to modern times, because if you want to actually recruit good people to fight in your military, you need to accommodate them in certain ways that doesn't antagonize them to not want to be around. And simple things like maybe having a very short, well-groomed beard, or, hey, I've got this neck tattoo, I'm really good at cybersecurity, maybe you should let me join anyways, things like that. So I think Natal makes a tremendous point here of how the Space Force can get off on the right foot. So now we know kind of their mission, what Space Force is up to, and how they're trying to brand themselves. Let's look at a few things that have gone in the early days of their foundation. And immediately, they're looking at what's going on recently in Russia. So Lieutenant General Saltzman said one lesson from the cyber attacks in Ukraine is that the main targets are not the satellites, but the ground systems, is according to spacenews.com. Almost 3 months into the war in Ukraine, it's still too early to draw conclusions about Russia's capabilities to disrupt satellite-based communications. But one takeaway is clear. It's the importance of protecting the ground systems and network user equipment that provide many entry points for cyber attackers, according to a U.S. Space Force official. Now, again, General Saltzman, who is the Deputy Chief of Space Operations for Nuclear and Cyber, said that he has been briefed on the details of Russian cyber attacks aimed at Ukrainian users of satellite internet services. Quote, one of the observations that I would offer on this is that if you think the only way to dismantle space capabilities is by shooting down satellites, you're missing the bigger picture, as these cyber attacks are on the ground networks. If the ground infrastructure that supports satellites become the main target, it's going to be important to have assured networks that are defended by cyber professionals. And we're not going to be effective in accomplishing our missions. I think that's a critical point that what we've learned from this environment. So again, you've heard me in so many of my past episodes talking about any large-scale kind of conflict aimed at the United States is going to be initiated by a cyber attack. I stand by that one. And this emphasizes the importance that Space Force is going to have in that kind of conflict, preventing our communications or in certain satellite communications capabilities to be taken down. So paralleling these lessons from Ukraine, the Space Force has begun setting up very specific units just to address new emerging space threats. According to Lieutenant General Whiting, who's the first commander of Space Operations Command, he explained that Space Force is standing up three new intelligence squadrons within the next couple of years. Quote, we're going to stand up a threat analysis squadron, a targeting squadron, and a PED squadron for procession, exploitation, and dissemination. So now, Whiting noted that there's increased threats from China and Russia, and he's been condemning the Kremlin's reckless behavior and testing its anti-satellite weapon system back in November 2021. He also said the Space Force must prepare against potential cyber attacks from North Korea and Iran, as those countries have lower space capabilities and digital threats have a kind of a lower bar to entry. For example, there's been a 31% increase in trackable objects in orbit since 2021, 31% increase, 64% increase since 2020, Whiting said. Now, we are seeing, quote, we are seeing other actors go to the moon, go to lunar orbit, and we do need to be concerned and interested in what they're doing there, Whiting said. Certainly today, we're more focused on terrestrial operations, but as commerce, like the private sector, as NASA, and as other countries start going to the moon and beyond, we'll have to pivot up and out toward the orbital regimes. And so I'm proud of the team as we start to look at, make sure that we're ahead of the threat. So this is a fascinating thing about the Space Force, generally speaking. As our technology enhances and proliferates across the world with other countries, we've been operating in space as a country for decades, but now it's becoming much more of almost a goal for many of these countries, especially as the issue of climate change continues to persist throughout many circles. It's this idea of what can we go beyond our own planet, and this the issue of defense as we journey outwards is they're parallel beside each other. Whether it's a commercial opportunity, space tourism, you name it, or even just having internet access, 5G internet access via satellites to any place in the world. All these things go hand in hand, the private sector and the Space Force will be working together, which is a point I wanted to make from a recent panel at the Center of Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. The U.S. government In pursuit of its advancements and participation in the space domain, can contribute through investments in STEM education. According to Dr. Joel Moser, he said that as well as through development of policies and regulations that strengthen space efforts. Now, Defense Department officials must have a unique perspective on space, how it can be used, and what it must be done to achieve national security objectives. Moser said, quote, firstly, it's going to shape the environment that we operate in and will evolve our mission to protect U.S. interests, both here on Earth and beyond in the future. Second, many of the technological innovations that are now coming and will continue to come from entrepreneurs and industrialists in the space business are from those entrepreneurs. We must harness those innovations for our mission to support the joint fight when we're called upon to do so. And finally, Moser said that those involved in the military's pursuit of space must overmatch America's strategic competitors. Space is now a warfighting domain. We must work with the industry as well as our allies to protect our ability to operate in that domain and defend our capabilities that ensure that they're there when we need them, as well as to ensure that the technological advantage in space goes to freedom-loving states who desire to keep space lines of commerce open for all. And this is a really fascinating idea. Obviously, anybody who's listening to this podcast, or everyone's got a smartphone pretty much, that piece of technology alone was cultivated from the defense industry. The GPS that allows you to find wherever you are on Google Maps. So many of the applications starting off as defense purposes then migrated to the private sector. It only emphasizes the point that as a country, as America requires our satellites and such technology to maintain our economic engine, as well as our national defense, space forces right along the private sector and entrepreneurs like Elon Musk are going to continue to work side by side to ensure both our desires for commerce, to operate as a tremendous economic, you know, power horse, as well as our ability to defend our interests here domestically and around the globe. Those two items are always going to run hand in hand, which is why there's going to be so much participation amongst the Space Force and its counterparts in the private sector. And lastly, for this episode, I wanted to close out with some changes we've seen in warfare. As in the past, communication units and communication weapons and technology were really seen as a support aspect of warfare, broadly speaking. You know, you had guys like me, you know, anyone serving a special operation unit or a line infantry unit who, or even perhaps, on the, say you had an Air Force or a naval capability. These are everything from strategic to tactical weapons. You know, the F-35 flying over the South China Sea, that's a strategic weapon. Or even the carrier group it's launching from, it's a strategic, you know, unit. Versus what we had thought of the past, like satellites, where those were there just to support the communications. Now, those technologies, the communications and satellite technologies, have really elevated their value because so much of modern warfare depends on our satellite technology. According to Space News, military space assets like satellites and ground systems typically have been considered support equipment that provide valuable services such as communications, navigation data, and early warning of missile launches. But as the Pentagon has grown increasingly dependent on space, satellites are becoming strategic assets and coveted targets for adversaries. Go back to episode 41. I talk a lot about this. The U.S. military space weapons that presumably would deter China from firing the first shot against a satellite are classified, but in a rare disclosure, the Space Force last year said it deployed an advanced ground-based communications jammer, which was made by a company called L3 Harris. I worked with them whenever I was in SF, that could be used as an offensive weapon to disrupt enemy satellite transmissions. The CEO, Chris Kubasak, said that there should be more awareness on the risk of an attack against a satellite precipitating a broader conflict. He's just reiterating the point I've made many times. Quote, I think it's the biggest threat facing our nation. A war in space could be detrimental to society because satellites play such a central role in everyday life for most people. If you think of the impact of war in space and how it impacts something as simple as our cell phones, navigation, supply chain, logistics, healthcare, I think it is a serious issue, and I think we have to continue to talk about it, according to Kubasak. Now, the military's reliance on commercial satellites for communications make these systems one of the most likely targets of enemy jammers and cyber disruptions, according to Travis Langster, vice president of CommSoc. It's a company that monitors space traffic and tracks orbital activities. Now, given the plethora of commercial space, based on the observations and activities we've seen at CommSoc, the target of the first shot is likely to be a commercial satellite. So what he's saying here is that in a cyber attack, for a war in space, it's going to be against a commercial satellite. That's his assessment. And by launching an electronic or cyber attack against a commercial satellite that is used by the Department of Defense for military operations, an enemy would be trying to send a very specific message that it does not draw a line between commercial and military space assets. The most likely scenario is what they call a reversible attack, meaning some temporary loss of space-based service. In this day and age, the first shot will likely be a cyber attack. So what he means there, not drawing a line between commercial and military space assets, it's that in the global economy, everything's interconnected. You know, we think of warfare so often as just these are the men on the ground, the planes in the sky, tanks, and so forth. But the reality is there's things like economic warfare, information warfare, cyber warfare, all these things I've hit on in past episodes. And so the idea that there is a distinction between the private sector, the American economy, and then our military, our enemies see those things intertwined because really they depend so much on each other, especially in the context of space warfare. This is the idea that I think is going to continue to push our military beyond just the Space Force, but all the branches, is how are we preparing for the next big conflict? Yes, we're adapting those tactics and procedures from the guys on the ground that are looking at operating in the South China Sea perhaps one day and how they can adjust their own tactics to be successful, you know, on an island, as well as the pilots, the naval commanders, etc., all looking at these different aspects. But it's that cyber warfare, that cyber attacks, and even the space warfare. Those are going to be such a critical factor on how that conflict unravels and reveals itself. This is why the creation of Space Force and the addition of cyber warfare capabilities for all our branches has been such a focus and is such an importance for the national security of the United States. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. More importantly, this series, learning more about each of our military branches. As always, I hope you are picking up what I'm putting down. I am Matt Parker. This is Brief Before Impact.